the honorable Richard Thompson. In particular, I'd like to move on to Standing Order 7.3, suspend Standing Order 7.1, in order to proceed with a government statement. Those in favor? Those against? Carried. The Speaker, I rise to provide further information to the House and to the public about the ongoing negotiations for the departure of the Gibraltar and the United Kingdom from the European Union. Speaker, making my address today, I'm conscious that the current Spanish Foreign Minister, Señor Borrell, made an address yesterday to the Spanish Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee. In the time since the Parliament last met, and I have voted the House further rounds of negotiations and being held with the Spanish negotiation team. As one of my members know, as a result of these ongoing negotiations, I decided not to attend the meeting of the Fourth Committee of the United Nations General Assembly. Instead, the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister attended the UN session in New York and delivered the address on behalf of Gibraltar. I think all of those of us who viewed Dr. Garcia's intervention would have seen as doing an excellent job in representing Gibraltar in that forum. It is important that the Speaker rightly reflect that the government of Chile considers that attendance at the UN is an essential part of the defence of Gibraltar. My decision not to attend this year was driven only by the exigencies of the Brexit negotiations. I was able to make that decision with the Speaker's faith in the knowledge that Gibraltar citizens would be able and properly represented by the Deputy Chief Minister. As a result, the Speaker traveled to London last week with the Deputy Chief Minister and the Attorney General. Dr. Garcia went on to New York and I remained in London to coordinate and strategize with colleagues in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. On Wednesday, I traveled to Brussels. On that day, I led the Gibraltar team in the negotiations which lasted until the early hours of the morning. The negotiations were held in the residence of the British Ambassador to the European Union on Rubicon. The Deputy Chief Minister traveled from New York direct to Brussels in order to join us after his address at the UN at Princeton University. He subsequently returned to Gibraltar late on Friday. The Attorney General remained in Brussels to continue the work of analysing and drafting documentation over the weekend. During the course of Saturday, Gibraltar was able to brief the whole of the Cabinet on the latest progress of the talk. I was also able to brief members of the Brexit Select Committee. I want to thank all members of the Select Committee, particularly Mr. Thiessen and Mr. Van Laan, for their support today. In the early hours of Sunday morning, the Speaker of the Deputy Chief Minister and I returned to Brussels to conduct a further round of negotiations. That evening, the negotiating teams of Spain, the United Kingdom and Gibraltar reconvened at Rubicao. We finished in the early hours of Monday. Honourable members will know, Mr. Speaker, that at that stage it was expected that the whole withdrawal agreement would have been finalised by Monday. The meeting of the surface of all the remaining 27 member states was expected for 4 p.m. on the Monday. That would have confirmed agreement from the member states to the draft agreement. In fact, as anybody keeping an even cursory eye on the news would know, the final agreement on other matters proved elusive and has not yet been finalised. The particular scope of the application of the withdrawal agreement to Gibraltar is, however, clearer now as a result of these further negotiating rounds. I want therefore to say something about the structure of the deal that has been put in place. There is now a third final protocol on Gibraltar, which will be a part of the withdrawal agreement. I think it's important to keep in mind that the withdrawal agreement is between the United Kingdom and the European Union. That is to say, it is not with each or any one of the member states. It is between the UK and the EU. And this means that various protocols that will be an integral part of the withdrawal agreement are also entered into between the Union and the United Kingdom. The protocol on Gibraltar is made different, Mr. Speaker. It is not between the United Kingdom and any particular member state. It is between the United Kingdom and the European Union. And this is text which is agreed, as it has to be, with Task Force 50, the group of legal experts of the European Commission, that have carried of the draft withdrawal agreement as a whole with the UK team at the Cabinet Office and the Department for Exiting the European Union. The Speaker, the protocol follows in great measure the structure of the Protocol of Northern Ireland, which is already public. It also addresses aspects of the structure of the arrangements being entered into. Some of my reflections today, Speaker, arise in the context of Señor Borrell's remarks yesterday. Speaker, the protocol on Gibraltar between the United Kingdom and the European Union is not yet finalised, but there are not many points outstanding. Señor Borrell also said yesterday that it was almost closed. He said also more categorically that it is closed and in green. So the Speaker, I interpret that as a reference to the analysis undertaken before the summer by the European Union's chief negotiator Michel Barnier and the former Brexit Secretary David Davis of the text of the majority, which was different parts in different colours. The green parts of the text were those that were agreed. In those circumstances, Speaker, I believe that there is genuine reason for optimism, that there is no longer any question mark whatsoever over the inclusion of Gibraltar in any transitional or implementation period. There is no longer talk of vetoing Gibraltar's inclusion in the transition or implementation period. In fact, Mr. Speaker, I think it is clear that neither the United Kingdom or Gibraltar have ever doubted the consistency of the case. And beyond the protocol, there are also to be a number of effective practical arrangements reflected in various memoranda of understanding. These will reflect the cooperation in areas where both sides have identified irritants, as I highlighted in my ministerial statement in March and in my last update to the South. At this stage, we reach a large number of agreements on the substance of the four-star memoranda. The first of these sets of practical arrangements will deal with the implementation of the rights of citizens, which are protected under the main majority. The second will deal with matters related to the environment. As all honourable members know, this has been an area in which Gibraltar has long wanted to cooperate with our neighbours. We have only one environment. There is no planet B, as President Macron has rightly said. The environment knows no boundaries, and we have long been keen to see cooperation in this area on a basis which is clearly without prejudice to the sovereignty, jurisdiction, and control position on which we would never compromise, expressly or impliedly, in any respect, in particular, in respect to Gibraltar's British Gibraltar territorial waters. The third memorandum addresses matters of police and customs cooperation. In this area, there has long been an excellent regional cooperation between our respective law enforcement agencies in many respects. Unfortunately, there have also been some very high profile instances of a lack of cooperation occurring between law enforcement agencies. We sincerely hope that we can leave disagreements behind and move toward more fluid cooperation. Mr. Speaker, the only one to assemble at the foot of this new approach to cooperation is the criminal. The fourth memorandum will deal with matters relating to the trade in tobacco in order to progress the shared agenda of working to control illicit tobacco activity and to protect our respective legitimate market. This is a key area of concern for me since my election, as honourable members will know. In fact, in my time in government, I've already increased the price of tobacco in Gibraltar by 148% since my election. I have said that recently, as in the last budget, that I consider this commodity to be on a permanent price escalator, and that the health consequences of tobacco consumption concern me and the government greatly. In this particular respect, I sincerely hope we will be able to move forward in the cooperation we enjoy with relevant agencies and competent authorities across the country. The work on the memorandum is not yet finalised, however, and we do want to continue discussions to seek agreement. Finally, Mr. Speaker, we're also seeking to try to agree a tax treaty to settle the perennial misunderstanding by some in Spain of our internationally accepted tax system. This memorandum is also not yet agreed. I don't know if it will be possible to reach final agreement in respect of this matter at this stage, but we continue our discussions to seek agreement. The technical work on this memorandum is being ably undertaken for Gibraltar by the Financial Secretary and the Commissioner of Income Tax and their senior Crown Council. On the airport, Mr. Speaker, after Robert Hill told the Spanish Foreign Affairs Select Committee yesterday, the position to be reflected would be the position of status quo. We have not found that the federal government of Spain prepared to move to implement the arrangements agreed in Cordoba by the former federal government of Spain in this respect. Honourable members know that those of us on this side of the House have our reservations about the Cordoba agreement. There are aspects of it that we did not like at all. We let them know the Cordoba airport agreement was defended by them in the 2007 general election and they won that election. As a result, they went on to spend in excess of £84 million of taxpayers' money, implementing the Gibraltar obligations under the Cordoba agreement. The government of Gibraltar takes the view that the Gibraltar side has complied with its obligations under the Cordoba agreement, and we are ready to see it come into effect. Mr. Speaker, there will be no change or progress in respect of enhanced use in relation to Gibraltar Airport, however. Finally, Mr. Speaker, I should reflect both my continued optimism that we will be in any implementation period agreed, as well as the reality that the negotiations are not yet over. For that reason, it's not yet possible or proven to share publicly our own analysis of each clause and how we have ensured that Gibraltar's interests are entirely protected. It is important that we should keep in mind that these negotiations have reached the designed to determine someone's blame and using voters to create a positive dynamic in Gibraltar. In New York at the United Nations, he spoke of a new relationship to create a mutual benefit for Gibraltar and the company who are best. And in the informal summit in Salzburg, he was clear about the fact that there are two different levels to the withdrawal aspects of the agreement. The UK-EU level and the practical level involving arrangements between Spain and Gibraltar. Today in Brussels, President Sanchez met with Prime Minister Theresa May and tweeted his view that he was confident that it was possible to reach a common agreement to finalise the Brexit negotiation and in respect of Gibraltar in a constructive spirit. We have welcomed that positive approach that leads to one side the failed science tradition of sovereignty, as was specifically agreed that in the justice and confirmed that in the Hill and his presidency of the country. Mr. Speaker, I will not say more as the negotiation is not yet over. It is therefore not yet possible to publish the text. That moment will come as soon as final agreement is reached and the full and final withdrawal agreement is published. But I am sure that I speak for every Gibraltarian when I say that we would never agree to anything which would in any way compromise, de facto or de jure, the sovereignty, jurisdiction, or control of any part of the territory of Gibraltar or of British Gibraltar territorial waters. I want to end, Mr. Speaker, by thanking all those who have supported me in this negotiation. The Deputy Chief Minister, the Attorney General, and the Financial Secretary have been the core team. The Cabinet have been fully involved. The UK team from the Foreign Office, and Majesty's Treasury, the Department for Exiting the European Union, and the Cabinet Office have been enormously supportive and helpful. But Mr. Speaker, I think for now, that is as much as I should say. Before I call the leader of opposition, I trust that I do not have to remind members of the opposition that established practice has over the years has imposed limitations on the extent which members of the opposition can intervene in response to a ministerial statement. The Honourable the Leader of the Opposition. Speaker, cognizant of your warning, Honourable Members, two of the members regarding loan contributions and statements, I will be short and brief, and I will conclude with asking two questions for further clarification. In general terms, Mr. Speaker, we welcome the Chief Minister's statement in which he updates this House as to the progress of the ongoing Brexit negotiations, as we, along with the United Kingdom, prepare to leave the European Union. It is right that we record that the Chief Minister has sought to provide a fuller and more lengthy briefing to my Honourable Learned Friend Mr. Peterson and my Honourable Friend Mr. Hammond at a meeting of the Brexit Select Committee last Saturday. The Prime Minister told the British Parliament on Monday that insofar as the vote is concerned, there have been positive and constructive negotiations taking place, but that they are still in progress. This is also repeated by the outgoing British Ambassador to Spain, Sam Manley, yesterday, alongside an upbeat assessment of the potential outcome for Gibraltar's future prosperity and that of our neighbour. We have been told by the Chief Minister that we are moments away from agreeing the terms and protocols to include Gibraltar in any withdrawal agreement and traditional transitional arrangements reached between the UK and the EU, and we are then told of his continuing optimism in relation to that. We understand from the Spanish Foreign Minister, Mr. Barrón, that the protocol with Gibraltar's inclusion in the UK and the EU withdrawal agreement is practically sealed. Whilst it was the government's choice not to seek our full participation at any stage in the process over the last 2 years, and whilst we reserve our judgment on the handling and outcome of those discussions, we wish the government all the very best in the delicate and technical work that remains in securing and protecting the best interests of the people of Gibraltar. In relation to the protocol and the five underlying memorandums so as to achieve the so-called soft landing of Gibraltar in the wider context of our starting news, we appreciate that the Chief Minister and his team bear a very heavy burden of securing the best outcome for our community, and that is why we continue to offer our assistance by way of full participation, and we again repeat that offer today. To my questions, Mr. Speaker, the first is, can the government confirm that once the memorandums are agreed in principle, that the Chief Minister will make a detailed statement to the House as to their terms and his assessment of the actual and potential implications of the five memorandum? Insofar as our second question is concerned. Mr. Speaker, in relation to the second question, a number of
afternoon to continually come up to members of the group and ask the question, what is the contingency, or how far are you involved in the process? Of course, our answer to that is, of course, we receive briefings and full briefings from the Chief Minister and his team. But one question I have is in relation to the contingency planning for a no deal, and whether the Chief Minister could explain in more detail as to what steps have been taken by the government to plan ahead in so far as no deal, no deal. Mr. Speaker, I thank you of the government for those questions. I do think we have got up to deliver a speech and then ask two questions, and I don't think that's in keeping with the rules of the House, and I want to record that. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman, in giving his address, has said that he was grateful for the fuller briefing that we were able to give in private. We've given very full briefings in private. Honourable Gentlemen do not know anything that we do not know about these negotiations. But I do say to them, Mr. Speaker, because in the context of those discussions, they have made suggestions which we have taken on board. What else does full participation mean? And is it the Honourable Gentleman is saying that I should be taking members of the opposition to the discussion and to the negotiations, Mr. Speaker? That has not been the case in the context of the way that they conducted the new affairs of this nation at the time that we were facing the joint sovereignty negotiations between the UK and Spain, etc. And we have chosen to go out of our way to ensure that we brief honourable members in great detail about everything that is happening in the negotiation. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, one of the reasons that I came back at the weekend was in order to be able to very fully brief the Cabinet and very fully brief them, brief them in exactly the same terms, so that they were aware of everything that was happening. We were able to look at the text as they were on Saturday morning. And the full participation means, Mr. Speaker, that the Honourable Member thinks that if he's going to become a part of the core team in the negotiation, whether that is prudent or wise, or at least a person who is not even a member of the South might be included in that negotiating team. So, Mr. Speaker, I don't think that that is in any way sensible or reflective of the way that things are done. I am speaking especially the two particular questions that you asked. Would I publish the memoranda once they are agreed in principle? I will publish the memoranda once they are agreed, and it is agreed between all of the relevant actors involved in respect of the memoranda that they will be published. Not just when they are agreed in principle, as soon as we are able to. So, being speaker, I want to publish them as soon as I can so the people can understand what the issues in this memoranda are and can see our analysis of every single word that has gone into them and the interplay between each word in each memorandum and the protocol and other memorandums. And finally, speaker, the issue of contingency for work of the government is very, very, very advanced. Now, this community is probably one of the few in Europe that understands what a contingency in respect of the non-movement of persons and the non-movement of goods might actually entail. We have lived through it, and that indeed. Probably a part of the people of Berlin, the people of Gibraltar, are among the few in Europe who in living memory will know what the contingencies entail. Just this morning, Mr. Speaker, I have seen an updated set of memoranda, internal memoranda, like with anybody else, and spreadsheets setting out exactly the details of how things would happen, when work would start. And but I would say this, Mr. Speaker, it's important that we all keep in mind in Gibraltar that we have not benefited from membership of the Common Customs Union today. And the biggest contingencies arise, although they also arise in respect of freedom of movement of capital potentially and services, but the biggest contingencies arise in respect of the freedom of movement of goods, and in particular, the Common Customs rules which would disappear for the United Kingdom overnight and for the European Union with the United Kingdom overnight in the event that there were no deal breakers. Those issues will not apply to Gibraltar. It is common ground between Gibraltar and Spain, not just in the negotiating room, but across the headlines that can be read around the world, that there will be no interference with the ability of people to move freely, even if there is an deal breaker. And so, Mr. Speaker, in those circumstances, honourable members should rest assured that plans are very advanced in the event of a well-known deal to ensure, as I've said repeatedly, that on the morning of the 30th of March, even if there were a no-deal Brexit, there should be no material you have will change to the lives of any person who needs to cross that frontier, or who relies on either side of the frontier, or on a service or a good moving to them, or towards them in order to be able to continue to run their businesses, or to live their lives as they have before them. I should add, of course, however, that this is a situation which is not in our season. We have not chosen to enter this negotiation. We have not chosen to leave the European Union. The people of the world have chosen to remain in the European Union. But the sum total of the choice of the British people was that we could leave. And we prepare for that eventuality when we didn't choose it. And we negotiate our inclusion of the withdrawal agreement, even though we did not choose that there should be such an agreement.
Mr. Speaker, I wish to thank the Chief Minister and the government for the briefings that they have provided to the opposition. And I'm very happy, not only as a Member of Parliament, but as an ordinary citizen, to hear the optimistic prognosis for the deals or the negotiations that have been had. I want to remind the government that I stand available for any help that I can give or any value that I can add at this crucial time for us all. I feel, Mr. Speaker, that I have to say, in front of contingency planning, I want to confirm that I have been briefed by the Deputy Chief Minister on contingency planning various times already as part of the Brexit briefing on matters of transport, fluidity, environment, law enforcement, and beyond. And I feel it is my place to let the world know that these matters are being looked at and have been discussed during the briefings that I have attended. I take this opportunity to wish the government well in finalising the negotiations. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
I know what the answer to this question is, but it's a question that is posed to me. And I think that perhaps I'd like to give the government the opportunity to deal with it so that perhaps some people who have asked me the question understand it better. What we are talking about in relation to this is essentially what the government is trying to do, and I'm asking the question, is to preserve as far as possible the status quo, what we have now, for the next 2 years until the UK exits the European Union. But the government is also, in parallel, working towards a potential situation where Gibraltar has a permanent deal that may provide Gibraltar with more European Union than the UK desires for itself. And can I ask that the government will not leave any stone unturned in order to protect Gibraltar's position in that regard, and ensure that in as far as possible, and I certainly am optimistic that it is possible, and I recognise there are all sorts of difficulties, but I believe that it is possible, that the government will work towards that permanent deal that secures Gibraltar's position, I believe, within critical areas of the EU, if I can put it that way, for an indefinite period of time after the UK leaves.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Honourable Gentleman for the opportunity to address this subject in this way. I think it's not disclosing any confidence that in the course of the discussions that we've had, that there's been a confluence of opinion between us that this is in fact the right course. And I value the opportunity to be able to say that in fact, in terms of the wider structure of this process, focusing which we did not wish to embark, there may be the opportunity which we have sought from the beginning to have what I have termed a differentiated solution for the data. Now, that differentiated solution is not so much a part of the process of withdrawal. The process of withdrawal extricates Gibraltar from the European Union in a different sort of membership to that of the UK already has. So we had a differentiated membership of the European Union to the UK, and therefore we must leave in a differentiated sort of way. As we look to the future, I think it's clear that although there will be a political statement of what the future framework is likely to be. There will not be a legal basis for that agreement, and indeed, honourable members of the decision of the news are discussing whether the implementation period should be extended, etc. All of that relates to how long it will take to conclude what in effect will be a new treaty between the United Kingdom and the European Union as to their trading relationships in the future. Some of the things that honourable members will have heard repeatedly relate to how the United Kingdom will approach the free movement aspect of that, and some of the trading aspects. And one of the key issues that we talk about in the context of this discussion is something called static alignment and something called dynamic alignment. So static alignment, Mr. Speaker, means that you agree to comply with the rules of the European Union as at the end of the implementation period. So you're bound by them until the end, and then the question is, are you then entirely released from those rules, and do you fall back on what is morally acceptable rules? So do you bind yourself into static alignment going forward in respect of the rules on labour, on the environment, on financial services, etc.? Or do you go into dynamic alignment, which means that although you're not a member of the European Union, you are in dynamic alignment with their rules as they change. Now, the other side of understanding dynamic alignment is the way that the Right Honourable Mr. Rees-Mogg might express it in the United Kingdom, or the former Foreign Secretary would say, you become a vassal state because you are then implementing rules you have no ability to influence. So, dynamic alignment means you have access to the market in the future because you accept the rules which you cannot influence, or it means that you are a vassal state, that you have access to the market in exchange for being a vassal state. So, many points of view in that respect. So the question that you go to is, how do we recalibrate our future relationships with the European Union? And as I sometimes might say in the course of discussions and forming with this colleague, we might want more EU than you, is the way that you might express it in shorthand. Because there might be aspects of free movement that are of great interest to the region, where we don't count on issue with immigration, where we have 14,000 people, it's quite remarkable, Mr. Speaker. I think you can say 6,000 people, or 7,000. 13,000 people now cross the frontier every day. And so I think it is hugely important to keep in mind that our attitude to free movement may be the complete opposite of the attitude to free movement that the United Kingdom may bring to the negotiating table when it comes to legally negotiating the future framework into a new international treaty between the United Kingdom and the European Union. And so we need to be differentiating that aspect. I think the choice to stay out of the customs union was absolutely the right one in 1972. I've said on a number of occasions already, but I don't know whether it is the right conclusion in 2020 or 21, when we leave the European Union at the end of an implementation period. At that time, the view might be, and I think it's a view that I hope we will take together in this House, Mr. Speaker, or indeed in a future iteration of this House after the next general election, that the right conclusion might be that we have membership in some way, shape, or form of the Common Customs Union and have access to it. Or it may not be, because there will be two sides to the coin. Some will think that they can set a price for that. And if it is a commercial price, well, you can figure that's what nations negotiate about, and that's how you adjust your market and you do so in this way that is most sensible for your people. If it's not a commercial price, and if anybody labors under any misapprehension, that anybody in this house or out of this house would be prepared to pay a price which is non-commercial, which crosses a line, or which even if it is not ostensibly a red flag on sovereignty, we all understand, and I think people in Gibraltar understand this better than most anywhere else in the world, that it does go to the ingredients of sovereignty, jurisdiction, and control, nobody can be prepared to pay the price. And the same is true of access to the market and services, where the issue of dynamic alignment is not so obvious, not as good. Dynamic alignment means the goods are homologated for access to the market in a particular way. With services, the homologation happens in a metaphysical way, but you have to accept the rules to regulate your market in that way, and you have access to the market. If the price is acceptance of the rules, well, as long as that is commercial acceptance of the rules, and not as I've said anything else, then that is something that I think we have an obligation to consider. We would not be serving future generations of the community as well as Mr. Speaker, the father of the House, and the Honourable Lady's father did in 1972 when they made the decisions that they made, which created the prosperity that we've had for the past 46 years. If we don't make some determination of what our final decisions are in respect of access to the single market of services and the single market in goods, what our decisions are in respect of the freedom of movement of persons and the fluidity that might come with that, and whether there is or not other potential common travel area-like solutions that we might seek to mirror with the same area. Those are the decisions we have to make. Those are the decisions that we have to bring to the negotiation table. I know that if there's going to be some direction into open, there should be determination and disputes arising from the European treaty by the European Court of Justice. It's very controversial in the United Kingdom. And so those issues which are the things I said before about our differentiated understanding of the European Union, our differentiated value to those things, the differentiated reality of our geography, all of those things together lead me to the same conclusion, General Gentleman, as I think hinted at in the context of the question that we just put. So as we look to the future, all of these things are the things that we need to consider together and determine together, that the solution, therefore, that we end up with, our future relationship with the European Union, and the Speaker, let's be very clear, the European Union, for us, will start in the limit. Those decisions are the decisions that we now have to make. I remember that in the old days, we used to say the European Union, or the European Economic Community, start at Europe Point, and the four corners, and then start again until the Pyrenees. We've left that club. We're going to be talking to that club about how we can have a relationship with them in the future. And that is going to be, for us as Speaker, as important to Muslims as it is at a human level. It is one of the things that that has been a pain to make sure is understood, is that some workers may, yes, be Spanish, and they may, yes, live in Spain, and they may come to Gibraltar every day. But what is our economy? The project maybe is not just about that, and it's not just about popping up to Madeira to do a bit of shopping or crossing over to eat some fried fish, or indeed for some to come over here to purchase perfumery or any other commodity. That frontier cuts across the heart and soul of many families and of many friendships. And seeing any barriers put up in particular, that those barriers should be born from something that happened, when the 50th anniversary of its closure will be a tragedy that certainly the government, I'm sure all members of the House, would not want to see, that we need any stone unturned to ensure that never happens again. Thank you. Thank you.
We are facing, Mr. Speaker, I'm going to sit down and I won't answer this, but we're facing the most important decision that the Gulf has faced in generations. The Honourable Member has said something, and I think it is important to emphasise an aspect of that, because it is important to this community. And I would ask the Speaker to give me the leeway to ask a question, and not to be over technical at this moment in time, because I don't think this is in that way.
Right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I think that the Honourable Chief Minister, Ivan Sesto, is absolutely right. The government has an obligation to future generations of Gibraltar to be most friendly and kind, the man of the UN. Indeed, he has a duty and an obligation to be in my respect to me, bold and ambitious in relation to you. So the question is this: does he not agree with me, and does he not think that it's important that a message comes out from this House, certainly from the Chief Minister tremendous, tremendous opportunity for Gibraltar and for Spain in particular, for the neighbouring region of Spain. Because if Gibraltar were able to reach a permanent, differentiated deal that gives us more Europe in the United Kingdom, the attraction of establishing Gibraltar and the consequent economic benefits for the neighbouring region in terms of improving economic activity would be absolutely tremendous. And that really we all have to work towards that goal with no sovereignty price attached. Because if there is going to be a sovereignty jurisdiction or control price attached, then it isn't going to happen. And it won't happen with the support of this side of the house.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I do think this is important. I'm grateful that you've allowed the Honourable Gentleman to follow through on his questioning on this. He knows me. He knows I'm bold and ambitious. And that fortune favours the bold, Mr. Speaker. And that's why 27 months ago, the Deputy Minister and I said we need a differentiated solution in respect of what the future represents for Gibraltar. It is also true, speaker, that we said that as people who believe in the European project. We continue to believe in the European project. But we are first and foremost British. And the United Kingdom is leading the European Union, and we are leading with the United Kingdom. And the European Union has not covered itself in glory in the way that it has dealt with Gibraltar in the past 24 months, probably the most adequate use of a number. Or indeed before, Mr. Speaker. But it is true that things are going well, we don't realise the value of things, but there have been a couple of real shocks for the European Union in my view, in the way that they have dealt with Gibraltar in the past 24 months, and I'm sure that this is something that he and I can agree on, and every member of this house too. So the result is this, that we have said on a number of occasions, and I know he is echoing this in the way that he presented this question, that Brexit can present an opportunity. And I have said on a number of occasions that I believe that opportunity can actually favour the whole of the region. You may recall that I tried to express that earlier this year by saying that it was possible if we work in a way that was designed to be positive and constructive rather than negative and destructive, to create a rainbow of opportunities that would touch every part of the Bay of Gibraltar. And I believe that is the case. I believe that the future framework can allow us, in its details, if we negotiate the right deal for Gibraltar, that right deal for Gibraltar is also the right deal for the area around Gibraltar, and that it can bring that shared prosperity that others suggest that they want to see in this area, which is not in any way being denied to the area by Gibraltar. In other words, it's not as if we've got a big cake that we're refusing to give half of to the people who live around us. It's that we believe that if the people around us are allowed, because I'm sure that they are able, if they are allowed to do the things that we do in the way that we do them, in the proper way that we do them, then they too can grow a case like this. And the neutrality of benefits is obvious, because we would want to be a territory that is prosperous as we are, next to a territory as prosperous as we are. And I think, Mr. Speaker, that as the Honourable Gentleman has indicated, there are opportunities to do that in the future if those with whom we have to negotiate are not, for one moment, thinking of sovereignty jurisdiction of the because I think it is absolutely clear that they will get no trust with anybody in this House or indeed outside it. And if they do think about how to design a good commercial arrangement that looks at the benefits that Gibraltar brings to the equation, the many geostrategic benefits that Gibraltar brings to the equation, as well as the professional benefits that Gibraltar brings to the equation. And in that way, I think we can create a real neutrality of interest and neutrality of benefit. The first step, however, is an orderly withdrawal. So, just to put that in context, we would be very unlikely to get to a positive differentiated solution going forward on the basis of us being in dynamic alignment with the European Union at the end of the implementation period, which is where we are talking about
talking about doing, and the UK will continue to follow the rules and the same rules for the end of the implementation period. We didn't have the implementation period. So we were out on the 29th of March, and the United Kingdom continued to have an implementation period. And at the end of the UK's implementation period, either we would have had to put ourselves into dynamic alignment without any of the benefits of the implementation period, or we would have to catch up, so we were still talking about that. Now, I think leaving us out of the implementation period would have been such a mark of upset, bad faith, that it might even have been possible to persuade all Americans to vote in, who voted remain, who have believed in the European project, who believe in the potential neutrality of benefits going forward, they might have been able to persuade us that we were wrong about them all the time. But those threats seem to have proceeded, common sense seems to have prevailed, and what the Honourable Gentleman has suggested in the context of his answer, which I have confirmed in the context of my reply, I hope, rather than his question in my reply, seems to be what we will see happening, which is that there will be an implementation period, that we will be able to have the benefit of that period to negotiate about the future, and that we will look to that future in a way that seeks to create neutrality of benefits and prosperity, not just here, but elsewhere, because that is indeed in our mutual interest.
The Honourable Roy Gleeson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have three questions, really, so it's really quite simple to the point. I heard with interest the Chief Minister mention that one of the protocols that's been discussed is in respect of adult treaty with the Kingdom of Spain, which I think would be, I must say to be fair, would be seminal if it is achieved to devolve to on a certain set a project on the future of a tax treaty. I would ask the Chief Minister, is it in parallel to structuring a dual tax treaty with the United Kingdom? Because that would clearly be a worthwhile exercise to conduct in parallel, so that in settling a treaty with Spain, we also have a treaty with the United Kingdom. The treaty with Spain, I understand, will be more relevant to cross-border workers who may suffer in unjust double taxation in the interim. But I think it would be worthwhile to hear if there is also a double tax treaty envisaged for the United Kingdom in the same timeframe. My second question, Mr. Speaker, relates to telecommunications. I haven't heard anything so far about telecommunications. I wonder if that's also included within one of the protocols, or if maybe, Mr. Speaker, they will not arise from the discussion that they may be covered by some other international treaty that doesn't seem affected by our withdrawal from the European Community. And finally, Speaker, in respect of the control of illicit domestic trade, obviously we welcome measures in that respect, but I'd like to hear confirmation from the Chief Minister that in respect of any fixed price differential that's being discussed with the Kingdom of Spain, that local industry is also being consulted on that. Thank you, Speaker. So, Speaker, I didn't say anything about double taxation. I'll read the Honourable Gentleman the bit that I read. I am Speaker, we're also seeking to try to agree a tax treaty to settle the perennial misunderstandings by some in Spain of our internationally accepted tax system. If the memorandum has also not yet agreed, I do not know if it will be possible to reach final agreement in respect of this matter at the stage, but we continue our discussions to seek agreement. Technical work on this memorandum is being ably undertaken by Portugal, by the Financial Secretary and the Commissioner for Income Tax and their senior Crown Council. So I didn't say anything about that exactly. But the Speaker, I have said, and the Honourable Gentleman has asked me whether we are pursuing a double taxation agreement with the United Kingdom, and I said as much in the context of the announcement that has been made after the Joint Ministerial Council for the Board of Directors from the European Union. There have been a number of statements in respect of that already. But Speaker, all the memorandum, and, or the memorandum rather, and the principle are all about the implementation period. The only bit that survives thereafter, unless we decide to continue those arrangements, would be the arrangement in respect of citizens who are exercising EU rights. That is what the withdrawal agreement provides for. And if the Honourable Members are familiar with the withdrawal agreement, they would know that that's it. Anything of the summer in 2016, the tapestry, but it was resolved by the European Commission on the first day of the first meeting and the first hour at the beginning of the summer, because we were told that the European Union did not discuss the future arrangements, just a political statement. And so, in that context, the issue of telecommunications will stay as it is until the end of the implementation period. Any future arrangements in respect to telecom are not going to have been discussed yet. The discussion has not yet opened. That discussion is not open, other than potentially in respect of a political statement, but no negotiation until after the United Kingdom has left the European Union. And in relation to that, Mr. Speaker, we are confident that any differentials that may be agreed will not affect players in the market. We have talked to all those that we talked to in the context of making determinations with respect to the stimulus in the budget.
One point of perhaps expansion rather than clarification. The two things are very well described, the situation as it exists at present, the protocols, the memorandum, and how they will work, and the fact that also the key players here are the United Kingdom, Gibraltar, and the Kingdom of Spain. Could the two things perhaps give us an appreciation of beyond the EU itself, breaking the EU down a little into the member states? Whether there has been contact with other member states, whether there have been sympathies towards the Baltic position change, whether some have been hostile, just a general flavour of where we stand, perhaps with some of the other individual states who may be also key players in the overall process.
Of course, I don't think that arises from my statement, but I'm happy to provide the answer. The fact is that the Deputy Minister put extensively to it, but I think the bulk of this work was done by the Deputy Commissioner and is done by the Deputy Commissioner in the capacity of both as Minister for Europe and for Minister for Leaving the European Union. Contradictory titles before the crown, whatever that might have been, for this period in our history. We've been in contact with all prominent representatives, that means all the ambassadors that the Member States have in the European Union, in Brussels. Remember, Brussels is a capital where most places have three ambassadors, the ambassador to NATO, the ambassador to the European Union, and the ambassador to Belgium. So we've been in permanent contact. So we've been in contact with all the permanent representatives of the other member states of the European Union, and we have been in touch with a number of those in greater detail, because there's been a community of interest with respect to Gibraltar, and their interest also. Of course, also the view, which I feel my friend, one of the gentlemen, quite extensively throughout the European Union, that the EU, and this particularly seminal moment in its history, should not be used by any one party to advance any claims it might have in respect of another party or a part of another party, when it comes to sovereignty, etc. There's been little critique or present attitude, other than the attitude rightly taken by Spain under Premier Justice and the vote, if they thought that they were going to bring sovereignty to the table in any way, and not just in any material respect, but in any way. And in that respect, the position of Premier Margalia, I think, was very clear, very well understood, and very much not shared by any one of the other 26 remaining member states, or indeed any one of these people.
Suspension of standing orders, the Honourable Chairperson.
Before I read the suspension of standing orders, and I ran straight into the suspension before because of the nature of the statement, I think the whole House will want to join me in congratulating the Gibraltar Football Association for their magnificent home win on Tuesday evening against Liechtenstein, their second successive win in the UEFA Cup of Nations. And I've seen so many comparisons to a London match. You know, you wait for ages, and then two come along, and the fantastic work of Sina in goal, both in Armenia and in Gibraltar, and the moment, Mr. Speaker, of utter joy that prepared me to hug the person next to me when the whistle was blown, and it happened to be my predecessor as Chief Minister. So the magic of football, Mr. Speaker, knows absolutely no bounds, and I'm sure that all House wants to congratulate the boys of the GFA for that magnificent award. proceed with the government motion. In Korea, those returns, married, the honourable the Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and the Force. I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name as Speaker of Parliament. The book house, approved by resolution, pursuant to the Section 46 of the Social Security Open Long-Term Benefits Scheme Act 1997, the making of the Social Security Open Long-Term Benefits Scheme Amendment of Benefits Order 2018.
I now propose a question in the terms of the motion moved by the Honourable the Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial and Labour. I'm proposing it, and therefore I then call on him to speak. Right.
The Honourable Mr. McGould. Mr. Speaker, following the Chief Minister's budget address of this year, which announced that the old age pension, I quote, old age pension will also increase with in line with inflation. And the quote, Mr. Speaker, the order which has been drafted before this house and which inflation is about, seeks to give effect to that measure. It is made as set out in the motion pursuant to Section 46 of the 1997 Act. Section 46 says, as follows, and it's not an amendment of rates of benefits. 46(1), the minister may by order amend the sum in section 22 above and the sum specified in pages 1 and 2 below. Section 22 refers to old age pension. Schedule 1 deals with pension contribution, which is dealt with separately. And schedule 2 refers to the rates, which are the rates which are being amended by the order attached to this motion. And section 2 of section 46 says, no order shall be made under this section unless it has been approved by resolution of Parliament. And that is precisely what we're doing with this motion, seeking a resolution of this Parliament so that we can amend the benefits, the rate of benefits, to actually increase them in line with inflation as set out by the Chief Minister of Peace during the budget. The rate at which it is increased is 2.5% with effect from 1st of August 2018, which represents the rate which was also mentioned by the Chief Minister during his speech when he referred to inflation. I beg to move the motion which stands in my name, and I put the motion to the House.
Now, put a question in terms of the motion proposed by the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and the Court. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. First and second reading. A bill for an act to amend the Financial Services Insurance Company Act. The Honourable Minister for Commerce. I am to be able to go for an act to amend the Financial Services Insurance Company Act for the first time. I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Financial Services Insurance Company Act be read a first time. Those in favor? Those against? Carried. The Financial Services Insurance Company Amendment Act 2018. Evidence of the contract which is entered into before the date of the application. The question of business is an insurance company to be responsible for failure after taking the decision to either cease operating from the data or cease operating in its entirety. The act does not envisage the scenario where an insurance company seeks to continue as an insurance contract despite working the transfer its entire or part, as in this case, of its portfolio to another entity. And the insurance company wishes to keep up those who follow the transfer to ensure that its market share and presence are maintained. It concluded from doing so by the wording of Section 1B of the Financial Services Insurance Company Act. Mr. Speaker, this amendment comes as a result of a presentation from a large diverse insurance firm seeking to transfer out of its existing entity a part of its portfolio business, namely EV business, to a different vehicle. The group is structured has been designed to second that vehicle for better to create it, and the sole and primary objective is that of protecting policy holders. This structure has resulted in significant cost to the firm itself, but to maintain its budget-proof legal business from within Gibraltar. The speaker has reviewed the EU directive that has been transposed into the Financial Services Insurance Company Act and the Financial Services Insurance Company Property 2 Directive Act. The aforementioned directives do not include any provision to limit the transferable code to the date of replication of the Dozen of Financial Services Insurance Company Act. We will propose Section 8.1 of Federal Code being under the following, where the transfer is devoid of any known share, and any policy including the proposed transfer evidence of the contract of direct insurance or reinsurance, the commission shall not approve the transfer unless it is also qualified that any policy included in the transfer evidence of the contract which is entered into before the effective date of the transfer, to the words which deal with the amendment and proposal. In the circumstances, the speaker will recommend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, is any other member to speak on their principles and laws for this bill?
I now
put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Financial Services Insurance Company Act is read a second time. Those in favour? As against, carried.
The Financial Services Insurance Company Amendment Act 2019.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to vote for the committee proposal and further to the bill be taken today before all the members agree.
Well, all members agree that the committee is taking further to the bill be taken today.
A bill for an act to amend the Traffic Act 2005 and the Insurance Motor Vehicle Third Party Risk Act 1986. The Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Traffic Act 2005 and the Insurance Motor Vehicle Third Party Risk Act 1986 be read a first time. I now put the question, which is, that a bill for an act to amend the Traffic Act 2005 and the Insurance Motor Vehicle First Party Risk Act 1986 be read a first time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. The Motor Vehicle Miscellaneous Amendments Act 2019.
I have the honour to move that the House of Resolvents vote into committee to consider the Financial Services and Insurance Company Act to close by vote.
A bill for an act to amend the Financial Services Insurance Company Act, Clauses 1 to 2, stands out of the group. The land title stands out of the group.
The Honourable Report that the Financial Services and Insurance Companies Amendment Bill 2018 has been considered in committee and agreed to, and I now move that they be read a third time and passed.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Financial Services and Insurance Companies Act be read a third time and passed. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
I move now to adjourn the House. Honourable members will want to know that whilst we were debating the, whilst we were considering the statement I made, the President Sanchez of Spain has made a statement in Brussels in which he has told the Assembly Principal that the protocol on Gibraltar is agreed in the context of Spain. I think that's just to update Honourable members with that, given that we were discussing exactly that point. I now move, Mr. Speaker, the House to adjourn to the 8th of November at 3 p.m.
I now propose that the House to adjourn to the 8th of November at 3 in the afternoon. Those in favour? Those against agree. The House will now adjourn to Thursday, the 8th of November at 3 in the afternoon.